The Tom Woods Show, episode 1094.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you thought Bernie Sanders and his ideas would just go away, boy, have you been proven wrong. Best way to fight back? Grab my free ebook, Bernie Sanders is Wrong, over at BernieIsWrong.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. What a provocative episode this one is. We're going to be talking with Brian Kaplan about his brand new book, The Case Against Education, Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money. Brian is a professor of economics at George Mason University. He holds his PhD in economics from Princeton University. And in fact, it's Princeton University Press that published this provocative book that I recommend highly. It is a great read. And it makes an overwhelming case. It's like Brian himself. You know, Brian is known for talking kind of fast. You just get overwhelmed. The book just overwhelms you with evidence and arguments. It's fantastic. It is so well done. And I know there are some libertarians out there who instinctively know there's something wrong with the education system, but they're on the defensive all the time because people seem to think that without the education system, everybody would be ignorant and nobody would have skills and everybody would be poor. And you're on the defensive all the time. And Brian gives you just an overwhelming case to help you push back against this. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I am a big fan of bold and blunt book titles, but I say this one really takes the prize, The Case Against Education, published by Princeton. No small feat that. Not the first time you've managed that. But what I like about this book from a bird's eye perspective is that it does not take the easy, relatively easy way of saying, you know, university or even high school education once had a noble purpose and it had noble beginnings. And if only we could get back to that because of all the nonsense that's crept in since then. You have given yourself a much more difficult task because you're saying, I'm not even convinced by the original noble purpose of this. So that
the schools ain't what they used to be and never were.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Right. And even if they could be, I wouldn't want them. So there's a lot to talk about here. First of all, you're basically going after the American church. The schools and the universities are the closest thing we have to an established religion. So you're going to face, you know, the most pushback, obviously, you've ever received. Even more than when you said people should have more kids.
So at least so far, people have been cool to me. But yeah, of course, I mean, if you just look at the number of Americans or the share of Americans that want to cut education spending, it's almost nobody. And that is precisely the main policy prescription I'm offering is we need to have less education. So yeah, it is really running afoul of our secular religion. But meaningly, honestly, those are the kinds of books I like to write. I like to write books where I think most people are wrong and they need to hear something else.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Now, it's funny. I found even my own views being challenged in this book, and I felt like I was pretty hardcore on stuff like this. It turns out that education, as it's practiced these days, it in no way does it live up to the almost ridiculous expectations, almost messianic expectations people have for it. So we've just come to accept, just through maybe intellectual laziness, that this is what happens to you for this number of years of your life. You sit in this regimented environment and people bark things at you. And if you complain that this is boring or this is material you're never going to need or you're going to forget it in 2 weeks, this shows you're a Philistine whose opinion isn't worth anything. But what you're showing in the book is that this is precisely the case, that people do forget things, that it doesn't take root in them, but yet somehow we stick to this idea that they've got to conform to this ritual, and they have to take things they have absolutely no interest in because we've decided they should.
Well, it's a bit more complicated than that. The main thing I say is that employers do use your education as a signaling device where they take a look at what your education is and they decide whether you're worthy of even receiving an interview, much less actually being offered employment. And again, the problem I say is that we are stuck in this equilibrium where if you were to go and say, I'm not learning anything useful in school, I'm going to quit, the main result would just be the employer say, well, then I'm going to throw your application in the trash. So how do you like that?
Right. So
it is a lot more decentralized. It's not, you know, so of course there is, you know, about $1 trillion of government money that is poured on the status quo every year. And yet if that were all that were going on, but employers didn't care about it, then you could say, fine, waste the money, but you're not going to waste it without me in school. I'm just going to go get a job. In practice, it's really hard for people to get any kind of at least a good job or even a moderately good job if you don't go and accumulate the required or the expected academic degrees.
Right. And you give numerous examples of why this really is the case, that if you were heading to your very final exam, and you've accumulated all the knowledge, but you're heading to your exam and you have an accident and you miss the exam and the professor won't give you a makeup, would you, and so therefore you don't get your degree, would you just say, all right, well, at least I have the knowledge, so I'll just move on? Or wouldn't you matriculate for one more semester?
Yeah.
Of course you would, to get that piece of paper.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, if you just go and look at the numbers, what's very striking is that so much of the payoff for education comes from the last year, from crossing the finish line. If the main thing that people were doing in school were learning useful skills, then it seems like every year should be about as good. If anything, it seems like senior year is generally goof-off year, where you'd be getting less. So, you know, like wondering, well, then why is senior year so important if there's nothing special in terms of the skills you're acquiring? And again, my answer is that in our society, people expect you to finish. We attach great significance to graduation. And so if a person says, I don't care about it, they are sending a very bad signal of nonconformity, a signal that frightens employers. Like, I don't want to hire a person who's that defiant, who's so disrespectful about the expectations of our society, right? And so, like, it's very important for people to finish, because if you don't, then you are voluntarily entering the pool of people that just defy the system. And, you know, who wants to hire them?
You have a chapter where you go through quite an astonishing series of surveys that purport to show how much people have learned in, or how much the average American knows about the sciences or politics or history.
Right.
And it is appalling. It's even worse than you think it is, because, of course, as you say, given that a lot of these are multiple choice, you have to correct for the fact that 25% of the time they'll guess through dumb luck.
Yeah.
And so, in other words, the system that we have now, by any conceivable standard, is a complete failure. And yet there's no real call to account for this. It genuinely is, we need more money. That is all they can think of. What other response is forthcoming about this?
Yeah, so, I mean, I would say you're going a little bit too far. So in literacy and numeracy, then at least most people have it.
That's right.
And if you're going to give the schools credit for it, then fine. All right, so, you know, they've achieved that for, you know, pretty, you know, most people, although even on literacy and numeracy, it's much worse than you would imagine. So, you know, a good rule of thumb is if the average college graduate is about as literate and numerate as you would mentally picture the average high school graduate.
Yeah. Right?
So I think that's a pretty good way to think about it. But for all the other subjects, that's where I totally sign on. And just, you know, roughly speaking, you can say, just imagine assembling a list of the easiest, most basic questions you can imagine about U.S. history or government, and then, or science, and then give that test to adult Americans, and basically they'll get about half of them right, right? And again, these questions are so basic that I would say this doesn't mean they are half scientifically literate. I'd say that it means they just don't know it at all,
right?
You know, the same way that if you only knew half the letters in the alphabet, you're not half literate; you are illiterate, because you lack like half of the most basic understanding of what's going on, which means you can't make heads or tails about anything in the real world.
Well, then what about people who say, but so imagine how much worse off they'd be if they didn't have our system?
Yeah, well, it'd be a matter of knowing next to nothing or nothing. And what's the difference? Right? I mean, my favorite example here is on foreign languages. So I was able to actually snap together a couple of different questions on the General Social Survey to get an idea about, first, you know, like how much foreign language, you know, like how much foreign language fluency do Americans say they acquire in school? Right? No, this is self-reported, so of course people are going to overstate. All right. So, if you just ask people, you know, so what fraction of Americans claim to have learned to speak a foreign language very well in school? And the answer is under 1%. So I say, look, if all you're accomplishing with 2 or 3 years of foreign language instruction in high school is under 1% of Americans claim to be learning to speak a foreign language very well there, what's the point?
And I've actually come to rethink my own views on education, because I see that there's some abstract value, certainly for me, in classical education. But I don't think, I'm not getting why a third grader should be studying ancient Greek. I don't see that. If you're the sort of person who finds reading the classical literature in the ancient languages to be extraordinarily rewarding, then you're the kind of person who can study that on your own. There's nobody stopping you. You have your whole life. Mm-hmm. But we're stuck in this mentality that if you're not learning something in the setting of formal education, then it doesn't really count. But of course, if you believe that this will enrich you in non-pecuniary ways, then go ahead and do it. Knock yourself out.
Yeah, and especially with the internet, it's easier than ever. Yes, what I say is, look, education does not have to be useful and it does not have to be inspiring, but it should be at least one.
Right.
So either you should be learning something that you're going to use in your future, or it should be something that makes that enriches your life. But if it doesn't accomplish either one, then why are you making kids do it, or why make adults do it? It's very hard to understand what the point of it is.
You have in one of the early chapters, you mentioned that you were going over people's knowledge of algebra and how much of it they retain in 5 years and in 25 years. And If they went on to calculus, then very often they do remember all their algebra and geometry, and which I certainly do because I teach it to my own kids now. But if I hadn't gone on to those higher levels, maybe I would have forgotten it. But maybe could the counter argument to what you're saying be that when you're, let's say, in junior high, there's really no way to know what you're going to do for a living. So isn't it best just to give you that mathematical and scientific background just in case, so that you don't get to be 18 years old and you don't know anything and you have to start from scratch?
Well, I mean, it's important to start with just base rates, like what fraction of people ever will use it. One of the fun things in that study of long-run retention of mathematical knowledge is that even out of the people that went on to calculus, I think only about 20% said they used algebra on their job.
Wow.
I thought that was, really? People like my dad, he was a PhD in engineering, but pretty quickly he was a manager, and then he wasn't actually using the math on the job to any significant extent. Again, the main thing I would say is, your basic point is definitely right, that you should be leaving kids' options open. But I say it's a lot better to go and expose them to 10 likely or realistic options than to a bunch of options that almost no one actually pursues. If a kid has been struggling in math in elementary school, the odds that he's going to become a scientist or mathematician is just phenomenally low. Better to go and expose him to 10 trades. Here's what being a plumber's like. Here's what being an electrician is like. That's a much, much better way of going. So yeah, I mean, of course, you don't know what a kid is going to like doing, but still you can focus on things that are plausible, things that are likely, and of course, things where there are jobs, also very important.
What's interesting here is that there is nevertheless, despite the craziness of the system, there is an education premium that people who go through the system seem to enjoy, and this is touted as evidence that the system works. You go to college, you earn more money, or whatever the statistic used to be, you earn an extra $1 million over the course of your career, whatever it is. And then some people have tried to respond to that by saying, well, maybe the causality is more, or the connection is more reversed, that the sort of person who would be ambitious enough to work hard enough to earn that money is the sort of person who completes tasks and goes through school. How do we account for this education premium?
Right. Well, the quick answer is that it's complicated. The longer answer is that some of the premium really does seem to be just what you're saying. It's actually a disguised reward for traits you would have had without school. Right. And there's a whole body of work where people go and try to compare apples and apples and say, look, if there's two people who had the same grades, the same SAT scores, and one goes to college and one doesn't, then what's the earnings difference between those people going to be? And yeah, that earnings difference is going to be a lot smaller than between the average college graduate and the average high school graduate. But still, after you peel off that part that education really doesn't cause, there still is a substantial effect in almost every estimate. And then what I say is, it's important to distinguish two different reasons why education might causally raise your earnings. One of them is this optimistic story that you're actually learning useful skills. But the other one, as I said, is that you're jumping through a bunch of hoops to impress employers. Now, selfishly speaking, it doesn't really matter why the education is causing earnings to go up. But from a social point of view, it matters a lot. Again, if kids are going to school and learning useful skills, then at least they are producing the extra stuff that they are earning. But on the other hand, if you're going there to get a bunch of stickers on your forehead, well, if everyone gets stickers on their forehead, then you just need more stickers to impress employers. So it is a futile rat race, insofar as what it's raising your income by impressing employers, right? And you can really see this in the real world because researchers have been looking at how much education do people in different occupations actually have over time. And what's amazing is that if you look at one and the same occupation today compared to 1940, on average, you need about 3 more years of education to get that job, even though it's hard to see why you would need more education to actually do it. And so this really fits a story where the more education you have, the more employers expect. And if you don't go and get the extra education other people are doing, then there's just a big stigma against you. So, I mean, think about how bad it would be to not have to be a high school dropout today when it's rare compared to 1940 when it was really common. And employers couldn't afford to say, I don't consider high school dropouts in 1940. Now it's pretty easy.
Okay. See, that's the issue that an individual who reads your book and is convinced by it would be facing, that if all of society acknowledged your thesis and said, you know, people are getting too many degrees, let's all retreat by 1 degree on average, and then it would all roughly be the same. We'd probably all get the same compensation that we're getting now. But if it doesn't happen that way, and just a few people say, yeah, I think this is a system that is not a good use of my time and whatever, that person will suffer because that person won't have the signaling, that won't have that degree that employers are expecting now. So how do we ever break out of this if all of society, wouldn't all of society have to accept your thesis to really make any progress here?
Fortunately not. Really, you just need a majority to go and vote for different education policies because, you know, while there is this personal incentive to go, this incentive is greatly enhanced by about $1 trillion of government money that's poured over the status quo every single year. Right. So, you know, there's a lot of work on how much does the cost of college or the cost of school affect attendance. And as you might expect, it matters a lot. Right. So, you know, there's actually quite a bit of demand elasticity. Most of the people doing this research, of course, want to have government make school cheaper so the more people go. But I just repurpose this research and say, fine, in that case, if we would go and make school more expensive, then fewer people would go. So if we were to cut out the government, reduce government subsidies, or if we were to raise the interest rates on student loans up to market levels, there's lots of things that you could do, all of which, according to the research, would reduce the amount of education people want to get. Which, again, if you thought that school was basically a place where you get useful job skills, would be scary. Because, like, well, then we're going to de-skill our whole workforce. But if my story is right, what's going to happen is not that the people are going to have a big fall in their skills. They won't, because they're not learning many skills in school. The main result is just that you can start your adult life earlier.
All right, fair enough. Now, how do you answer people who would just summarize your thesis by saying, oh, you just hate college?
Yeah, so I mean, personally, I feel great about it. So, I mean, I have a dream job for life. I'm a tenured professor. My life was wonderful. I can get paid a nice income to do whatever I feel like doing, really, do what I love. Yeah, so I don't have any negative feelings towards college. I mean, like, it's a fine place for me. I mean, I just think the taxpayers are getting ripped off, and I also know there's a lot of students whose time is being wasted. You know, not that they won't go and get a better job, but they're bored, they're not happy, they're not interested in the material. So, I mean, I think at least I ought to stand up and be a whistleblower and say, hey, people, this is a great deal for me, but it's not a great deal for you guys. Thought you ought to know.
Well, let's talk then about vocational training. There's a stigma attached to it because people feel like because we've imbibed this idea of what education is and we should be studying ancient Greek and everything, we look down on people who actually know how to do things. There's a disaster going on in the water system in your house. I don't know what to do about it, but that guy that I've been taught to disparage, he darn well knows. How does vocational training fit into the way you look at how the world ought to be?
Yeah. There's a good amount of research on vocational education and main results. You know, it's like first one is that just selfishly speaking, vocational education is underused. It seems like, you know, students are actually making a mistake. And, you know, like even if you don't go work in the exact occupation that you were trained in, still it just acclimates you to employment. So that's good. And, you know, so there's quite a bit of research showing that vocational education leads to higher earnings and lower unemployment. So, I mean, selfishly speaking, it just seems like you don't do enough of it. And again, especially, of course, for kids who just hate school, kids who hate sitting in a classroom listening to some windbag talk, for them, vocational education is especially good because they really just resent the regular kind so much that to do something else that works for them, at least that they might enjoy, might be good at, is a great alternative. But then I say, even better from a social point of view, because, if you're spending taxpayer money to teach people skills, that's much less wasteful than spending taxpayer money to have people put a bunch of stickers on their foreheads, right? So, Now, we both share a strong libertarian philosophical orientation. So again, I'm not actually endorsing government subsidies for vocational education so much as just saying, look, if government is going to spend the money, this is a much better way of spending it. And, you know, I think that's a fair way of thinking about it. Right. And again, you can look at countries like Germany and Switzerland where they do have a bigger role for vocational education, really much bigger. And, you know, like it's striking how there's very little underclass in those countries, and the kind of people that would end up in the underclass here instead, when they're 13 or 14 or 15, trained to be a plumber or a carpenter, right? And, you know, at a German or Swiss level of skill, right? And then they're an independent adult instead of being permanently unemployed or in jail, which, you know, seems like a huge improvement.
I want to say a little something, if we could, about child labor, because this is a this is a very sensitive term. Child labor evokes images of kids who are all filthy, working in factories and in terrible conditions. I mean, that really, I think, even today is what the term evokes. But secondly, there's a prejudice against it because we believe that the correct way of going about it is that the kid sits in a classroom all day. And so because dissent from that is blasphemy, and because we associate child labor with primitive, backward, laissez-faire, well, it's unthinkable. But there are so many valuable things that kids could be doing and learning at reasonable ages that are simply foreclosed today.
Yeah, you know, I have a section of the book called In Praise of Child Labor, where I begin with a quote from an economic historian who says, you know, look, in like the 19th century, people defended child labor in very much the same terms as we defend education today, saying, sure, the kid doesn't like it, but it's good for his future. Right. And I read that and say, yeah, well, of course. Yeah. So, you know, kid may not like the job, but you're preparing him for adult life. And if you say, well, it's just terrible that you're depriving a kid of his childhood, kids should be running and playing. Well, what do you think they're doing in classrooms? Are they running and playing in classrooms? No, they're sitting there being bored, made to conform. So if you're willing to just accept the idea that kids sometimes need to do things that aren't that fun for the benefit of their future, then I don't see what the problem with child labor is. And then I say, look, obviously, child labor has, it provides a lot of useful training, just acclimating people to employment and teaching them how to deal with coworkers and customers and an employer, right? All great things for kids to learn. Of course, you can learn specific useful skills. And then just the double standard that we apply to kids having jobs versus schools is shocking. So if someone does an unpaid internship, it's like, oh, that's so terrible. They're being exploited. They're working. They're not getting paid. Whereas if you go to school, of course, if you could do it for free, you would consider it fantastic, right? So schools, it's okay for them to charge you to train you, but employers, if they do it for free, then somehow they're ripping you off, and that's bad. And again, like obviously there can be abuses with child labor, but there can be abuses with school. You know, my mom went to an old-fashioned school in the 30s where the nuns whacked children with sticks, right? That doesn't mean that all school is bad. And the fact that there are some bad treatment of kids in school doesn't mean that's bad. You know, what I say is, given that we rely upon parents to judge what's best for their kids in almost every other area, your parent can go and take you to, take you on a trip to Congo. If they want, your parents can go and do skydiving with you or mountain climbing. So, that's okay for parents to do. Why isn't it just up to employers about whether or not a job is suitable for their kid?
How about this? Suppose you're listening to an inspirational, motivational speech at an inner city school, and they're saying to high schoolers, look, a lot of your parents and their parents have been stuck in a rut. But you have a great opportunity. Let's say they had all just gotten college scholarships. Mm-hmm. This is your chance to break free from the limitations that have beset your own families. And now this is the thing that's going to get you out of here. If Brian Kaplan then follows up with his own speech, what would that say?
Well, that's tough. You know, I think I would have to say, look, you're not going to like what I have to tell you, but here's the honest truth. Most of you are going to drop out of, are not going to be able to finish college. Right. So, I mean, I say, look, let's go and take a look at what your SAT scores were, what your grades were. If you are at the top of the class, then this is probably a good deal for you. But on the other hand, if you're average, then the realistic result is first year probably. And, why not go and think about something that is a realistic ambition, which again, probably is just to find a job and to learn a trade. Right. I know people throw tomatoes at me for that, but. And, I think that's the honest answer. Yeah. So, in terms of like the selfish payoff for education. So again, mostly in the book, I just focus on how selfishly it's good, but socially it's bad. Although I also go on to say, well, right now there's so many people who have been pressured into going to school and taught it's the only thing for them to do, that there's a good number of college students who actually was a bad idea for them to go just because their academic preparation was so poor that their odds of finishing are really low. And since so much of the payoff for college comes from graduation, if you don't have a good chance of finishing, then again, probably not a good idea to go.
Given the educational options on the internet, which is still, these are still classes in the mold of traditional education, but they can be delivered to you a lot more inexpensively. Do you think that the system we have now is going to experience a major shakeup or major challenges, or is it so entrenched that it's not going anywhere?
Yeah, it's really entrenched. So here's the thing, online education is great, but it competes with blogs and podcasts. It doesn't compete with regular education. I've never heard of anyone who said, I just went and got an online degree, or I just taught myself all this stuff, and then I was able to go and get a great job. Employers are nervous because, why didn't you go to a real college? Why did you try to take the easy way out? What's wrong with you? Right? And especially since one of the main things that education is signaling is just sheer conformity. If you go and say, well, I'll go and signal my conformity in a brand new, original, creative way, that doesn't signal conformity. That signals nonconformity. You're trying to weasel out of social expectations. I love online education as a way for people to receive enlightenment. Right. And a lot of it's going on, right here on this podcast. You're spreading enlightenment and intellectual joy to your audience. But it's not reasonable to think this is going to lead to employment. Have you ever heard someone said, I listened to all your podcasts and I was able to get a job with that?
That's true.
Yeah, sounds pretty fanciful.
It does.
Here's one case that I thought was really striking. So my colleagues, Alex Tabrak and Tyler Cowan, have their own online university, Martian Revolution University. Mm-hmm. I think they got about 10,000 people to sign up for their intro econ class. And then they offered a midterm. Right? How many people do you think actually took the midterm?
Oh, I don't.
10,000 students.
Oh, tell me, how many?
He was 4.
Oh, that's even worse than I thought. I was thinking 50.
It was a great product and a great class, great teachers, but these people viewed it as edutainment, not as an alternative way to be certified as an economist.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Because I have libertyclassroom.com, and the initial classes did have some quizzes and stuff like that. And then I realized nobody wants them. Almost nobody is interested in it. They just want – they feel like it's adult enrichment and something they can listen to while they're driving. But they're out of school now. The last thing in the world they want to do is take a test.
Yeah, and yet if you go and read Educational Psychology, which I did very extensively for this book, you'll find that frequent quizzes are one of the best validated ways of actually causing learning.
Yeah, certainly in my case, I think that is probably true.
Yeah, because it's so easy to fool yourself into thinking you understand something until you actually go and sit by yourself with a piece of paper and try to answer some questions. And then say, oh, I only thought I understood. I'm not actually able to go and intelligently discuss this yet. I need to go back and listen and think about it some more.
Can I ask you just one more thing about
a type of
argument that people will make is one of the subsidiary benefits of education would be either it would help you to network or it would help younger kids to be socialized?
Yeah, so the socializing one is absolutely true. It's just a compared to what question. So if it's either go to school or play video games in your home alone for 13 years, then sure, school is a way better way to get socialized. On the other hand, if it's either go to school until you are 22 or go and become an apprentice when you're 14, then I think it's totally unclear that school is actually better. So in most ways, actually a job is providing better socialization. It's teaching you that there are customers and you need to make them happy and that you need to get along with your coworkers and produce an actual product. Socialization compared to nothing, school is good. Compared to what else you could have, it's not clear that it's even in the running. It seems like it's probably worse. For the other question about getting valuable contacts, again, in school you get contacts, in work you get contacts, so either way you'd be getting contacts. The real question is the quality of the contacts. The main problem with contacts you meet in school is that the modern economy is so diverse and most majors are so unrelated to any industry that the odds that one of your fellow students will ever be in a position to help you is quite low. again, this is not true if like you're doing computer science at Stanford, then your fellow students are super useful. But if you're an English major, what are the odds you're ever going to be doing business with the kid that was sitting next to you in class? Astronomically low. So on the other hand, if you go and start working in a particular industry, then you're going to meet all kinds of people that are useful to you. And again, there's a whole sociological literature on the value of connections. And basically what it says is there's two kinds of really valuable connections. One is close relatives in any area, because close relatives will go to bat for you. And the other one is highly relevant contacts, people that already work in the exact industry where you want to work, or that could be the clients of your clients in that industry. Those are the kinds of contacts that are worthwhile. There's this famous paper by Granovetter on the strength of weak ties, like 30,000 citations. And as far as I could tell, virtually every other person who studied the topic said Granovetter's wrong, but somehow you get 30,000 citations out of that. You don't get benefits out of knowing tons of people vaguely. You get benefits out of having a few people that are super useful and or love you.
And of course, if you could just get out of your comfort zone a little bit, go to a trade show or a conference relevant to your industry, and
totally.
That kind of concentrated event with so many people there would do a lot more good for you in terms of contacts than hoping that, you know, the guy sitting next to you in 10th grade is gonna open doors for you. Let's talk about debates you have coming up. This is being broadcast Wednesday, February 14th, 2018. You have a debate coming up on this very sort of topic tomorrow somewhere.
Yeah. So Washington, D.C. at the American Enterprise Institute, I'm debating great education economist Eric Hanushek. And then in May, I'm doing the Soho Forum against great Harvard economist Ed Glaser.
Yeah, that's May 14th. And we all know the Soho Forum, listeners here, because of our friend Gene Epstein. It's at thesohoforum.org. And when you go there, there's so many interesting debates. You want to go to all of them. It's one of the reasons I wish I lived in New York City. It's not quite strong enough to get me there, but it's an outstanding institution, because the very fact that the resolution, I was saying this to Gene, the resolution you're debating is all government support of higher education should be abolished. This is the sort of thing that a progressive would say, I can't believe it's the year 2018. We have to even debate this? Didn't we win this years ago? Making people re-examine something they thought was a closed question is so important. Now, that's real education. So the book is The Case Against Education. I'm linking to it on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1094.
Yeah, but it's only $20 on Amazon now, by the way.
Oh, come on. For heaven's sake, people, don't even listen to the rest of this episode. Go grab this, because you are going to take such delight in this book, not only because it's so thorough and well-argued, but also because there's something, I don't know, naughty about reading it. I mean, you know, you are really going up against established ways of thinking. Right, you know, naughty in an academic sense, you understand. So go check it out, The Case Against Education. Brian Kaplan, good luck with it, and thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom. Always a pleasure.
All right, everybody. Do pick up The Case Against Education. I'm linking to it at tomwoods.com/1094. Tomorrow, Sherry Clark joins me. She's known as Sherry Voluntary. We're going to talk about women and libertarianism and a whole lot more. So make sure you've subscribed on iTunes or Stitcher. You can find the subscription links over at tomwoods.com, particularly tomwoods.com/episodes has the list of all 1,094 episodes of this show in one convenient place. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.